Hey, everybody. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Welcome to Beekeeping for Newbies. Thank you very, very much for taking the time to join us today. I do appreciate you. And as always, feel free to reach out, Jeff, at beekeepingfornewbies.com. It's N-E-W-B-E-E-S.com. Well, today we are on episode 175. And as you, for those of you keeping track at home, you probably are aware that we have done no interviews this year. There's been a lot going on, and it's been a busy year. And, you know, I'm pretty selective as to who I have on, and I was really so focused on so many other things that bringing people on was not really a high priority. But this fall, like late summer, early fall, there have been so many discussions where we've started diving a lot deeper into, you know, winterization and preparing your hives and things that are important. And this is kind of an area that I've been dedicating a little bit more of my own study to kind of improve my game and hopefully be able to share information with all of you. And if you look back to episodes, 169, prepping your hives for winter, episode 170, talking about natural cavities and comparing the natural cavity in the tree to what is, you know, in a Langstroth hive or other types of hive configurations, going through, you know, some of our, you know, clustering general, what's inside the cluster and how the cluster functions. All these recent episodes have been really geared around all things getting ready for winter, basically. So with that theme in mind, I have a guest today. I think you guys are going to absolutely love her and you're going to really enjoy the discussion. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce everybody to Peg DeSanto. Good afternoon, Peg. How are you today?
I'm well. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for joining us, especially on the short notice. I wanted to get a chance to chat with you. So for everyone out there, we had a listener who is a member of our Discord room, and they had reached out to me and said, "Hey, Jeff, I've got a couple things I think are kind of interesting. I want to get you two connected together." And that's how Peg and I came together. And we'll give you a little more information on that later on. But Peg, if you would, if you can just take a few minutes and share a little bit about you, where you are, anything you feel might be good to share with the folks out there.
Sure. Well, I am from Minnesota. I've been a beekeeper for 8 years and also a registered nurse for 38 years. But, you know, ironically, it is kind of my years as a nurse that got me into the beehive sort of expert in winterization systems. And so I can kind of talk about that a little bit later. But yeah, my nursing career sensitized me to, I worked ICU, emergency room, chemotherapy, and I got really, really aware of how precious life is. You know, I had been on the Code Blue team and I've done chest compressions on people, and I've really been with people as they fought for their lives. And I just realized that life is precious, all life, not just human life, insect life as well. I've been a vegetarian for 15 years. And so, yeah, in the winter, I kept losing half of my colonies year after year, and I was devastated. I started crying. I felt sick. I mean, I'm hardwired to save lives, and, you know, my bees' lives were on me. And so it really motivated me to try to find a solution. I figured there's got to be a better way. The Bee Informed Partnership said 50 to 60% colony loss is the average in northern climates. And I just thought, you know, if our dogs, half of our dogs died outside every winter, people would just be like, oh, well, that's just how the ball bounces. And so something in me just got very motivated to figure out what the solution is in helping to save our bees in the winter. So that's got me sort of kickstarted into becoming, I mean, not an expert, I mean, goodness gracious, far from that, but I've really put a lot of my life force into trying to find a better way to overwinter bees. So I've done a fair amount of research, and that's how I landed here. It's from my own personal loss and sensitivity to we got to do better by our bees.
You know, that's a great intro, and a lot of what you said just now really resonated with me. Yeah, so I think that there is a connection, and I haven't exactly figured it out, but I know, so I do have a little nonprofit that I do some things with called the Healing Hive Project, and it's all around veterans and first responders and getting them connected to beekeeping and therapy through beekeeping. But I see something very consistent in, you know, in the space broadly of those who are coming from fast-paced, you know, life-threatening kind of environments and things, who come into beekeeping and find it to be very therapeutic and relaxing, and there's just something really special about it. But that reverence for life thing is a huge, it's like a walk of life. Part of the walk you go through in your journey of life, when you get to the point where you really gain that appreciation, love, and respect for your impact on everything that's around you.
Right. No, it's changed me. I mean, it really has changed my relationships. It's changed my outlook on life. When you see people, literally four-year-olds, you know, giving chemo to a four-year-old, fighting for their life, you just don't take things for granted. And you go that extra mile to make a difference in people's lives and make a difference in, you know, all life, honeybees' lives. So I'm a much better person for my years as a nurse. I wouldn't take that back.
So I guess, you know, as you first start in beekeeping and you're in those first couple of years, you have this thing where, like, every single bee, you know, you can't close the hive up because there's that one bee left behind. And it's really challenging, especially if you ever try to transition to like a sideliner or on the commercial side of things, where you're slinging boxes all day long and there's lots of collateral damage associated with that. And I think that it's interesting to see, you know, I don't want people who are new beekeepers to lose sight of the importance of every bee, but it's that balance of, you know, you can't stand there all day and make sure that every single one of them makes it back. And I think that we see that a lot when it comes to like mite washes. You know, I've heard several people say, well, I don't do mite washes. I'm not sacrificing 300 bees. And the answer I always kind of try to give in that space is, yeah, I get it. But then you have to shift over, which I think is hugely relevant when you're talking about overwintering, is viewing the colony as like a super organism kind of thing. It's not just, I look at individual bees as like cells within that organism that form the tissues and the organs of the hive. So it's like, it's that challenge of, yes, I understand that each one of them is important, but for the greater good of the colony, these are the things we do.
I agree with you. I feel like, you know, the hive consciousness is every single bee does whatever it does for the greater good of the colony, period. And so if the bees were given a choice, like, hey, well, 300 of you give your lives so that we can do this alcohol test so we can improve the betterment of the health of the colony, I believe they would, because that's their consciousness. So I believe that's how they roll anyway. I mean, the fact that when they sting, they die, and so, but they're not worried about their individual lives. It's the greater good of the whole colony. And so, yeah, I do believe that would also be their choice or their consciousness, is they would give their life to know, like, how sick are we? Do we need treatment? I mean, where are we at?
So you mentioned that, you know, of course, so you're still in Minnesota today, you said?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this is great that we have you, because we have a lot of people who are beekeeping in British Columbia, Manitoba. We've got folks in Montana. We've got at least 6 or 7 active people who I communicate with regularly out of Michigan. There is a gentleman who's up, I think he's in Finland, up in the Arctic Circle. We've got one or two folks from Alaska. So we have a lot of people that are in these cooler climates. And I get questions all the time. People will email and they say, hey, Jeff, I am in, you know, wherever, it doesn't matter, North Dakota, I'm in Wyoming. This is what I've got. This is how many frames of this, you know, X, Y, and Z. What do you think I need? What do you think is the best way? Should I wrap? Should I do this? Should I do that? Have you found some things that you would say are, because I recognize there are certain geographic elements to it, right? If you are in this particular area, well, you have different challenges than this other area, but would you say that there are 2, 3, 10, like, just generic tips or things that you can say that, regardless of where you are, if you start doing these things, you're going to increase your colony's survivability substantially just with a couple of small changes?
Yeah, that's a fair question. I get a lot of questions from people all over the country as well. Similar, like, well, what do I need? What's appropriate for my climate zone? Or I live on the coast and it's really humid. So I want to back up a little bit and sort of talk about overall winterizing principles, and then we can sort of get more into the weed level about specific areas, because it'll help answer the second question if we kind of look at overwintering principles as sort of the umbrella topic. And where I'd like to start with that is, as I mentioned, I did a deep dive into the science on overwintering bees. And there are two, like, really clear divisions amongst beekeepers as to what is killing our bees. Half of them say it's the moisture, it's wet bees, and half of them say it's the cold. It's you know, freezing cold bees. And the research actually says everybody's right. It is indeed both. And unless we beekeepers solve for both moisture and cold, we're not going to have very good outcomes. And so the million-dollar question is, how do you solve for both? And I want to just go down sort of the tract of moisture. So what happens in a bee colony is, as bees consume honey, a byproduct of metabolism is water vapor. Same with humans. As we digest our food, we exhale water vapor. But when that water vapor that the bees exhale hits a surface in their hive at the dew point, and not to get all scientific on you, but the dew point is a temperature where water vapor literally turns into liquid water. So like if you're, you know, out, you know, having a beer and your can of beer starts getting condensation on it, it's because the temperature of the beer can is at the dew point, or water vapor in the air hit it and it turned into liquid water. So that's the moisture problem in a beehive, is when their exhaled water vapor hits a surface in the hive at the dew point. And if that surface is the ceiling of the hive, and that water that's condensing starts dripping down on the bees, your bees are not long for this world. Wet bees are dead bees. So that's the, like, glaring moisture problem. But unfortunately, what a lot of beekeepers do to manage moisture is they start drilling holes in their hive boxes to vent that moisture out. Similar, like if you're in a car in the winter and you're talking or laughing a bunch and your exhaled water vapor starts fogging up the windows in the car, to get rid of that, you know, condensation, you crack the windows or turn on the vent and bring in cold, fresh air. And so that's what beekeepers like, oh, well, it works in the car, it probably works in the beehive, so let's, you know, put on a quilt box that holds it, or drill holes in our hive boxes. And so certainly the moisture gets vented out these holes, but what happens is the heat leaves with it, and it's a lot of heat. It's like the chimney effect. Cold air comes in the lower entrance and pushes up and out the moisture and hot air, so you've got this constant and continual source of heat loss. So you sort of solved for the moisture problem, but now you just created a cold problem. So people are like, well, what do you do if we can't vent out the moisture? And this is where science really is clear. It's consistent. I mean, all the big researchers, Etienne Tardif, Derek Mitchell, Tom Seeley, Randy Oliver, the data, the science says, the key to solving for both is you don't vent. You close up all entrances except for the lower entrance. And the way you keep the bees dry is you super insulate the top of the hive to keep it above dew point. You want to insulate it like three times what you insulate the sidewalls. You also insulate the sidewalls, again, kind of depending on what climate zone. But being the sidewalls are cooler, condensation actually is allowed to form there, because that is where you do want the dew point to be reached, so that the bees actually have access to this very precious moisture. Bees need moisture to dilute their honey and for hydration. And so it's called a condensing hive. And it's called a condensing hive because it promotes and encourages condensation to occur in the hive, but just not on the ceiling. So it's very simple, you know, sort of approach. Super insulate the top of the hive, also insulate the sidewalls, but less, and allow condensation to stay off the ceiling, and it pushes it to the sidewalls where the bees have access to it. And this is another interesting piece of research, that when you provide adequate insulation, and this comes from Derek Mitchell, who has, he has a PhD at Leeds University, he said when we under-insulate or don't insulate our colonies, that the bees start clustering, right, to generate heat. They vibrate their wing muscles to generate heat. That in well-insulated hives that are not vented, the bees actually don't cluster at all. Etienne Tardif, who is in the Yukon, his bees don't cluster at all because he provides such great amount of insulation. And so when the bees aren't clustering, they're free to roam around in there, and they can walk over to the sidewalls to access the moisture condensing there. And so that's sort of the backstory of how do you solve for moisture and cold, and it's the condensing hive approach. So back to your question, well, how much insulation do you do? Top insulation, side insulation? And I want to refer to a research study done in 2023 by Tom Seeley, and he basically looked at what are the qualities of a natural tree cavity. Bees have evolved for millions of years in natural tree cavities. And so he literally like cut open a bunch of tree cavities and measured, because he wanted to be able to tell beekeepers, this is how much you need to insulate your Langstroth hives in order for it to be the same as a natural tree cavity where bees would choose to live in. And this is where we start getting some numbers, quantifying how much insulation. Seeley's study said we need to provide an R30 on the top and an R10 on the sidewalls. And very briefly, R values, the R stands for resistance to heat loss, like how much does the material slow down heat loss. In Minnesota, new construction attics have a minimum of R49. Just to give you a reference. So now he's telling beekeepers, R30 on top and R10 on the sidewalls. And so, you know, we've got some numbers. And Seeley's study was done in climate zone 5. And so pretty much the climate zone 5 or colder, so 1 through 5, the research is saying R30 on top and 10 on the sidewalls. Etienne Tardif, that I mentioned, who's in the Yukon, he does R40 on top and 10 to 20 on the sidewalls. So similar, just obviously a bit more in the Yukon, but similar is Seeley. So even though, you know, Etienne isn't overwintering because Seeley's study told him to do that, he's just done a ton of research and he knows those are the R values needed to keep his bees from clustering. So that's a little bit of a kind of a longer answer to what climate zone needs how much insulation. And I do also want to just point out that we've also done some research comparing like an R value 30 on the ceiling to an R value 10 in Wisconsin. And an R value 10 on the ceiling, the bees colonies were still running in the 40s and 50s temperature Fahrenheit. Where in R30, the internal temperature of the colonies are running high 60s to 70. So significant difference between an R10 and an R30. And so it really reinforced the Seeley study that you really need that R30. Because, I apologize if I'm going way too much into the numbers, at about, and this is Etienne's research, around 50 to 55 degrees is the temperature that the bees start clustering and vibrating their wing muscles to generate heat. So you got to keep the internal hive temperatures above 50 or 55 degrees. And the R30 does that. Any less, and they hang down in these, you know, zones in the 50s where the bees are still going into a high metabolic demand state. So I would say zones 1 through 5, R30 on the top, 10 on the sidewalls, warmer climate zones than that. I would say from just being in the realm of bee winterization and insulation, you could get by with just an R10, 20 on the top and probably don't need sidewall insulation. So 75% of the heat loss, according to Bill Heschbeck, who's a master beekeeper out east, who's really kind of the grandfather of condensing hives. He coined that term, sort of the first to write about it and talk about it. So keeping the hive top insulated, he said 75% of the heat loss is the top of the hive, 25% off the sidewalls. So if you're going to insulate one place in these warmer climate zones, insulate the top. And, you know, R10, R20 should be enough to provide that protection to keep your bees out of that high stress, high metabolic demand rate. So, Jeff, does that answer your question? Probably more than you're hoping for.
No, that's absolutely perfect. That's great. And that's what I love to hear, because there's so many moving parts to it. You know, as you were talking about it, I was thinking about, I think I had mentioned to you by email, this bit of a study that I'm getting ready to conduct. And I think if anybody who had a chance to listen to the episode that was released at midnight tonight, so it was released today, it's the full details of the project I have coming up, where I'm going to be basically getting everything set up with non-insulated hives and also some insulated hives in varying configurations with nucleus colonies, 8-frame, 10-frame, single deeps, single nukes, double deeps, several different configurations, both insulated and non-insulated. And then I have these various sensors that are going to be in monitoring, you know, heat, pressure, humidity. And then I also have some little heating pads that I'm going to be programming through various, you know, my former IT career stuff coming out here, but I'll be programming some things in to basically move the heat to simulate a clustered group of bees moving from point A to point B, push that data up to a website that has a heat map, and then people can, you know, anywhere can just go and look at this and view this data. That first cup of coffee really sets the tone for the whole day. If you haven't tried an AeroPress yet, you're in for something special. AeroPress uses a unique brewing method that delivers a smooth, rich, and balanced cup of coffee with less bitterness. So you actually taste the roast, the origin, and the full character of the beans. Smooth, balanced, and full-bodied. It's like the best part of a French press, a pour-over, and even espresso combined into one compact brewer. And it's built for real life. Durable, portable, and consistently great whether you're at home, at work, on the road, camping, or traveling anywhere life takes you. Plus, it's the fastest single cup maker out there. About 2 minutes start to finish, including cleanup, so you're never waiting long for great coffee. AeroPress is shockingly affordable, less than $50, and we've got an incredible offer. Visit aeropress.com/honey, that's AEROPRESS.com/honey, and use promo code honey to save 20% off your order. That's aeropress.com/honey, promo code honey at checkout. So ditch the drive-through, skip the bulky gear, and start your mornings with a better cup of coffee wherever you are. Big thanks to AeroPress for sponsoring this show. But there's a lot more moving parts to it. You know, when you were talking about, in my mind, I was always thinking the idea is to get the bees down to a nice, comfortable temperature where they're in a balance zone. I didn't really know what that temperature was going to be, but into a balance to where they just kind of, you know, mellowed out and they could just progressively just move the cluster where they needed to. I really had no idea that that they were targeting or even getting to temperatures. I recognize that, you know, when you get outside the cluster, out, you know, out to the mantle of the cluster itself, you know, the temperatures certainly can drop, and then obviously they're much warmer towards the core. But being, you know, that warm in the hive, the only question that I have, which I'm sure you've got an answer to, is there any kind of an increase in food consumption when you have this increase to activity, since they're not really locked? I guess if they're locked together in a cluster and they're generating heat, then they're consuming honey probably no more than they would be if they were just wandering around through the hive. Probably you can argue more that they're consuming more.
That is a good question. There was actually a research study done in Australia that looked at the metabolic rate of the bee on one axis, and the other axis was literally temperature. And so they could see, like, how hard is the bee working? And then it also translated that into honey consumption. And it was the same data that Etienne came up with, that at about 50 to 55 degrees, the metabolic rate of the bee, as it got colder, literally skyrocketed. Super steep incline in metabolic demand, the colder the bees got. Above 60 degrees, some people kind of think, well, as they get more active because it's warmer now, it's 70, 80, 90 degrees, the metabolic demand went up a little bit, but very little. So clearly it's the cold that causes extreme, you know, stress states, high metabolic demand states that drives increased honey consumption. Etienne Tardif's bees because they're so well insulated and they don't cluster, he has less honey consumption in the Yukon than beekeepers down in the States. And so, and there's a lot of research studies that confirm this, that well insulated colonies, the bees have 30 to 50% less honey consumption because it goes hand in hand with how cold they are. They need energy to vibrate their wing muscles to generate heat, and that energy is in the form of honey. So they absolutely eat more honey the colder they are.
So that's a question, again, that comes up a lot as well. Hey, you know, I'm in XYZ state. How many frames or how many supers or, you know, how much honey do I need to overwinter? And I think that that was, I think I was guilty of that too very early on, trying to equate, you know, pounds of honey to, you know, well, if you're above this latitude, you probably need this much type of thing. Not exactly, but roughly, you know, just,
yeah.
And, you know, the question shifted entirely when somebody told me about Edian years ago and they were like, oh yeah, this guy overwinters nukes up in the Yukon. And I was like, no, you don't. And they said, oh yeah, he does.
And gets 90 to 100% survival.
Yeah. And right? I was, but again, yeah, you've got to look at everything holistically and you've got to take into consideration the level of effort that he went into to figure out, you know, to kind of crack the code and figure out what needed to be done. But then now to me, it's an area that I really have started studying within the past year. I've started paying a lot more attention because I keep thinking there's got to be a different way. There's got to be a better way. Like, you know, I was kind of going through the similar journey, I think, that you were. So, which is great. Now that I have you, I can just point everything to you. And well, go ask Peg. But now that I understand that dynamic, it opens things up in such ways. I was mentioning to somebody just the other day, I said, now that we have this better understanding of this, you can do those later season splits and still probably be able to overwinter them. When you start in the spring, you're probably going to have bigger, healthier colonies. You're probably going to see a 50 to 100% increase in your overall productivity and probably a 100% decrease in your expenses when it comes to feeding and supplements and all these other things. Because if you're using a traditional hive kind of Langstroth setup with, you know, 5/8, 3/4 inch, you know, kind of hardware, then you're basically having to get them really, really boosted. Like at this time of year, you're 2-to-1 sugar syrup and trying to get them to pack it away because you don't have a choice. But leveraging some kind of a capability to keep that insulation, keep that heat in place. I love the numbers that you're sharing though, because I think that's aside from just being highly relevant, it gives people a kind of a target or a mindset. It definitely helps me out as I'm trying to figure out what's going to make sense, you know, within the project that I'm working on. Because one of the things I'm doing is every hive is going to have a meter on it that's measuring how much electricity is required to sustain the heat level within that hive. So then we can be able to see what the efficiencies are across all of them. But having a real target temperature is definitely going to be of benefit for everyone.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's definitely, the goal is to keep them above 55 degrees. And that's when the lower metabolic states happen and less honey consumption, less stress. And I'll go into that a little bit later, but I want to circle back to the question you sort of touched on, is how much honey do you leave the colonies to overwinter on? And typically we say a deep frame of honey, a full deep, is about 7 pounds. And in climate zone 3, and, you know, I would say really 1 through 5, we recommend leaving 12 to 14 full frames of honey in a double deep. So that's close to 80 to 100 pounds of honey. And I will tell you, in very well insulated hives, like a 30 on the top and a 10 on the sidewalls, the bees will consume 30 to 50% less honey than a poorly insulated hive. So the bees will not consume that much. But Etienne's research says honey is a really good thermal mass, and it like holds on to heat.
Yes.
So even though the bees won't need it for, you know, for consuming, it's just good to leave it in the colony if at all possible. And I want to just sort of also explain a little bit of Etienne's research, because he deserves a huge shout out. He'll put, so there's these little sensors, you know, Broodminder or other companies make these sensors, and they're smaller than a matchbox. And Etienne will put 20 of these in a single hive. And then he'll repeat that for multiple hives, and then he'll just switch out the winterization approach, ventilate, not ventilate. He'll even switch the size of the ventilation hole, different amounts of insulation. And over the years he's been doing that, he literally has millions of data points. Like every couple inches inside his hive, he can tell you the temperature and relative humidity. He can tell you, you know, if there's, you know, heat loss areas, ventilation channels. And so the point is, like, the data has gotten so sophisticated that it's not a mystery anymore what's going on inside our beehives in the winter. Like, the science can inform us as to, like, the best practice. The data is there. And so I just wanted to touch on that, is that Etienne's, he's done a ton of research, and he's a brilliant, he's an engineer, and he's an extremely intelligent man. And so, you know, as a nurse, everything we do in medicine to save lives, human lives, is based in science. And so I'm a big fan of, what does the science say? And the science says, Dad, do a condensing hive. It's by far the best approach to getting your bees over the winter. And it's a little bit new. I mean, this research is sort of new in the last 5 years. And so beekeepers, my hope is to help spread the education on what the research and the data says, that this is the optimal way. It's best practice. And I want to circle back to the natural tree cavities, the Seeley study. Guess what the qualities of a natural tree cavity are?
Well, I kind of know a little bit. I don't want to spoil it. I don't want to spoil it.
I'm sorry. Yeah. Yeah, it's a condensing hive. The natural tree cavities, the bees chose cavities without upper entrances. They liked enclosures with just a lower entrance. They liked live trees because of that thermal mass. And then there was sort of this infinite amount of insulation above the enclosure, so the R30, and they liked trees with very thick sidewalls, and that's the R10. And so natural tree cavities are condensing hives. And so even though we have all this research saying condensing hives are the way to go, if we would have just, like, Seeley's Darwinian beekeeping, looked at these tree cavities long ago, you know, the bees are... They know, you know. I mean, think of like the Apame hive, which is a lovely hive because it has insulated sidewalls. But it would have been lovely if they would have put an R30 on the top of their ceiling instead of venting it. And I know the next model, they removed the vents because the bees were populizing them up anyway. But yeah, the bees know. And so, condensing hive is the way to go, and the bees do it naturally anyway.
Yeah, it's funny that you mentioned that last comment about how the bees propolized those upper, you know, that upper ventilation, you know, once it was presented. And I saw the exact same thing, and I mentioned it to you earlier, and I've mentioned it several times on the podcast as well as to people in our Discord room about it's a Honey Run Apiaries product, but it's the all season inner cover. And in the center, just like an inner cover, it has a kind of a little bit of a handle there that you can get into, and it comes with just some number 8 hardware cloth to cover that up, because the idea is not to obviously let the bees into that space, because in the winter you put the 2-inch foam insulation block in there, which provides, you know, a little bit of insulation, nowhere near the R30, but definitely provides some insulation. And what I've told people, and they've messaged me like, hey, I'm using this thing, but the bees propolized that whole thing shut this summer. What do I do? I said, don't worry about it. Just drop the block in there and keep going. But it goes right to your point. Like, they know exactly what they want, and you'll see it by all of the activity wherever, mm-hmm. those, just like in the tree, if they find a tree that meets the criteria of what they're looking for and there's a second or third entrance, well, they'll just propolize it shut and keep on going. But it's interesting, mm-hmm. and fascinating. I feel bad because, you know, as we go through, you know, our own individual beekeeping journey, and we kind of, you know, map out our path, or I guess it's almost in hindsight, looking back at our path, I've always said to people, don't try to get too, I think that while beekeepers love their bees and they want to do what's best for them, sometimes we can be our own worst enemy. And I've said, what do the bees do in the wild? You know, become the tree. And I've always said, well, you know, look at your beehive today, you know, the bees that are in the trees out there in this cavity, they don't have this or they don't have that. So I don't do these things. But one area that I definitely failed everybody, and it was, you know, just me pouring my heart out at the mercy of the listeners, but I would say, hey, you know, follow what's in the, you know, in the wild. You know, you don't have, you know, trees. Nobody comes up and wraps a tree. Nobody comes up and I kind of really did not, and it's simple. It's not a real complex concept when you really start thinking about it. It just never really dawned on me the fact that you said, you know, like the infinite insulation above and below inside the tree. I don't know why that never really clicked, but I've started to gain a real appreciation and recognition for the fact that, you know, you can't, the Langstroth hive is not designed for that. It's not designed to handle some of those more extreme climates.
No, I mean, yeah, people sometimes say, oh, you know, we just let bees do their thing. You know, we don't really, you know, kind of fuss with what they do to survive. But I would tell you a bee in Minnesota would never choose a Langstroth hive to overwinter in. And so to say, oh, we don't need to do anything, let bees be bees, it's like, well, then don't put them in a Langstroth hive because that's not fair. You know, if you want bees to be bees, then do what they would do in the wild. And so there's just some misunderstandings of what sort of natural beekeeping, and that's different than whether you treat or not treat, but just sort of like we don't need to fuss with them and provide insulation. That's not true. We really do. For us to provide them with what they would do if they were allowed to be in a natural tree cavity.
Yeah, that's a great point. When you make that crossover from, you know, a wild, you know, wild animal, insect, whatever it might be, and then it is now managed, whether it's a managed herd of, you know, cattle or, you know, anything that might be managed, it's animal husbandry in one capacity or another. Once you make that commitment, you go down that path, you know, you have a lot of responsibility that comes with that. And that's challenging, right? Trying to figure that out, especially for new beekeepers. There's so many new beekeepers out there. And, you know, one of the challenges I've seen quite a bit is I can go on right now from Minnesota and do a video and say, hey, this is exactly what I do for my hives. This is how you overwinter, and this is how you do this. And I can do all these videos around all the things that need to be done. And all of those things are 100% accurate. If you're probably 20, 50, maybe 100 miles away from where I'm standing, but
exactly.
For somebody in Texas or Florida or, you know, up in Alaska or any other, all these other places, there are so many unique elements and aspects to all the dynamics of beekeeping, which is where it becomes more challenging. And I do a lot of the, hey, this is what I do and I've had success with, but where you are, and this is where I've had a big emphasis on trying to join bee clubs and forming some local connections and build your local beekeeping network so that you can have people to bounce ideas off of. I guarantee you pretty much most places have at least one person who's got 15, 20 years experience. Get connected to them and say, hey, what are you guys doing? What did your granddad do? What, you know, what's been going on here for a while? And then bring that together with the technology of today, and you can get a real unstoppable formula.
Yes, exactly. Right. Yep, well said.
I get really geeked out about things, especially when you talk about like technology within the hive. And, you know, so you mentioned the Edian with the 20 sensors in a single hive. I think that the way mine are set up, it's single devices that then have 20 probes or, you know, something like that.
Nice.
I think I've got one. Yeah, I think one of them is actually going to have, I want to say the math has me at 28 probes, I think, in a double deep configuration. Yeah, so it's basically in between frames 1 and 2 is where it'll start. So I'm not going to put a sensor against the wall, the frame in the wall, but between 1 and 2 all the way up to between 9 and 10, and they're going to have between 2 to 3 sensors per space. That's just for the starting initial iteration of it. But yeah, it's pretty easy to get excited by some of those things.
Like you said, your IT background is bleeding through in your enthusiasm, which is lovely. I'm glad there's brilliant people like you out there to you know, pull this data together. It's not my specialty. And I'm super grateful for all the scientists out there who've done the background to help us know, you know, how to take care of our bees better. So that's fantastic. You're into that as well.
Well, it's kind of a, you know, bit of a good, I guess, transition, you know, coming out of IT and then, you know, dedicating everything to beekeeping, you know, full time. It's allowed me to kind of dabble back in a little bit, but now I'm much more focused on like the research side of things and trying to put together things that I can then put out to others and say, hey, this is what I saw, you know, give me your feedback. What are you seeing? What's contradictory? What do we need to do additional research on? And, you know, how can we kind of continue to just share and grow the knowledge, you know, broadly across all of us?
Yeah, and I'm glad to, you know, be networking with you and be part of that data collection. That's exciting stuff. I do, if there is a time, to share a little bit more about, you know, going back to sort of the conversation about cold versus moisture. There are a couple other teaching points that I feel are worthwhile sharing that beekeepers might not know about, that I didn't know about until I kind of delved into this area. And it has to do with the time of year when the bees start, or the queen starts raising brood, because a lot of beekeepers reach out and they've lost their colony in the spring, and they're confused, mm-hmm. and they're frustrated, like, you know, it's March, you know, my bees made it through and, you know, subarctic temps in February, and then they up and died in March. And I just want to share that the reason, and in fact, spring is the time of the highest mortality rate of any season. And this might be obvious, but it's because when the queen starts raising brood, these old, tired winter bees, I mean, we're talking probably almost 200 days old now. And if they were cold, they're stressed. And now when there's brood present, they need to, like, activate their glands, take care of baby bees. But even more so, they need to heat the brood to 95 degrees. And at least in Minnesota, I mean, in the spring, we can get 10 degrees, you know, that's not unusual. And so now if the ambient temperature is 10 degrees and they need to raise the brood nest to 95 degrees, that's an 85 degree temperature difference, that's the heat they need to generate. And if there's like a cold snap and they can't maintain that brood zone of 95 degrees, these tired worker bees will just quit trying. And without this replacement brood, I mean, these guys, these old winter bees, are on their way out. And without replacement brood, your colony's in trouble. And so a very critical time of the year to provide insulation. And don't be in a hurry to leave it on until the temps again are like in the 50s, when they're out of that sort of cold, you know, cold dips risk area for dropping temps and chilling the brood. I wanted to share that as far as like another benefit of winterizing your colony or providing really good insulation. Another study I wanted to share about was done in the USDA, and this was 2023, where they actually looked at bee immune health, honeybees' immune strength. And the research showed that cold bees have weaker immune systems, because the energy that these cold bees have to put forth to try to thermoregulate robs their immune system from energy and life force. And so cold bees are sicker, more, you know, viruses, bacteria, and they die sooner. And so there's, you know, there's another reason to not have your bees cold in the winter.
Well, everyone, hopefully it's not a surprise to you that I have to break the discussion with Peg up into two episodes, part one and part two. I hope you enjoyed part one. I really had a great time talking with Peg. I think part two is even better. So I'm going to go ahead and close out this episode, and then we're going to release part two this Thursday, just a couple days from now, and you can hear the continuation of my discussion with Peg. Thank you so much for taking the time to listen, and don't forget that I love you, and there's nothing you can do about it. We'll talk to you soon.